Listen, the birds sing. Listen, the bells ring. All the living are dead, and the dead are all living. The war is over, and we are beginning.
Chapter 10. I love the first snow of the season. Natasha's voice is as soft as the expression on her face. She's dreamy and wistful as she stares out the big windows in Rachel and Beck's living room, watching the snow collect on the balcony outside. The sky is pinkish, with fluffy flakes illuminated in the streetlights. The whole world looks quiet. "I always hated it," Steve confesses, "even if it's beautiful and still out there. Used to mean I was probably about to be bedridden and ill for the whole winter. And that you'd have to cut back on the booze to afford to heat your place," Rachel says, from the other end of the room where she and Beck are huddled down by the fire. "Yeah," Steve grimaces. He misses getting drunk. "The snow was even worse during the war. Frozen ground, and then mud when it melted, which was worse if you ask me." "Wow, you are a bucket of laughs tonight." Natasha rolls her eyes and dumps something from a flask into her coffee. That does actually make Steve laugh. "It really is pretty out there." "I know." "Bublé," Rachel says. "Throw another log on?" "Yes, ma'am." "And don't you call me that." Steve laughs again. He's been doing that a lot more in the weeks since Thanksgiving. Laughing. It was a good holiday. The food was delicious. Clint and Natasha were a hit with the kids, even if Olive, director of everything at the Barnes house, had to veto all of Clint's ideas for pre-dinner entertainment. Tony was shockingly subdued, drinking steadily and sticking close to Rachel and Beck. Bruce showed up for dessert, and as the sun was setting, Steve and Clint threw around a couple baseballs with the kids in the street, like it was 1932, the whole thing devolving into a game of how bad can we make these throws and have Hawkeye still catch them. After the kids went to bed and the adults got serious about drinking, Rachel flirted shamelessly with Natasha while Beck rolled her eyes. Steve laughed more in one afternoon than he has collectively in all the years since 1941. For the first time in the 21st century, Steve only missed Bucky every few minutes instead of constantly. And Rachel, still so observant even in her old age, noticed. She saw Steve smiling, and somehow they've had at least one guest for dinner on every Thursday since the holiday. Tonight, it's just Natasha. "Any word from Tony?" she asks. "Should we wait on him for dessert? I want pie." Steve shakes his head. Tony is not very good at knowing what day of the week it is or how much time has passed since he slept, but since Thanksgiving, he's been better about showing up almost on time for Thursday night dinners, tonight being the glaring exception. "I don't know if I should be worried or not." Steve looks at his phone again, in case there are any new notifications since he last looked at it 10 seconds ago. "I mean, he's a flighty fella, right? But he's been here every week since Thanksgiving. Maybe I should go to the tower and check on him." "You should," says Rachel, patting her hair like she's done when she's nervous for 70 years. "He always looks so thin these days. Not just skinny, but stretched thin. Don't you think, Rebecca?" "Taking a bomb through a space portal and then almost falling to your death from said space portal will do that to you," Beck replies. "Space portals don't even make the list of Steve's nightmares. He's seen men mowed down by machine gun fire and vaporized by strange Hydra weapons. He let Bucky fall from a train. Sometimes he's still startled over his own two big hands. Space portals don't have him batting a goddamn eyelash." "I'll go into the city after pie," Steve decides. "He's not there," says Natasha. She scrolls through something on her phone and then tosses it to Steve without ever looking up at him. He snatches it out of the air with no effort, grinning at her. Even in this setting, they're so attuned to each other. All that training, And, he admits it, goofing off with his shield, is paying off. On the screen are a series of paparazzi shots, taken through a chain-link fence outside a private airstrip, surrounded by palm trees and sunshine. In the first, Tony is getting off a small private jet, and in the next, he's basically hurling himself into Pepper's arms, where she waits on the runway below. Then there are a series of pictures of them walking back to the awaiting car, hand in hand. "Good," says Steve. It seemed like he was having a hard time while she was out of town. Natasha hums her agreement, catching her phone without looking away from the window when Steve tosses it back. He's in California with Pepper, he explains to Rachel and Beck as he pulls his own phone out of his pocket. He scrolls down through the couple messages he sent to Tony when he didn't show for dinner, all unanswered, and sends a new one. "The sunshine will do you good, Stark. Tell Pepper we say hi." 2 seconds later, his phone buzzes. Tony sent him 5 kissy-faced emojis, lips pink and puckered. Steve laughs, and then tosses his phone to Natasha when she holds out a hand, silently demanding to see what has Steve so delighted. "That's a nifty tricky," says Rachel. "Like juggling." "What? Are you two a couple of superheroes or something?" 2 minutes later, a giant snowball hits the sliding glass door, shortly followed by another. "Clint." Natasha beams as she rises from her seat. "I thought he was on a mission," Steve says, following close behind her. They pull on boots and then brave the snow to go out on the balcony, peering over the edge. Sure enough, there is Clint in a puffy purple jacket, wielding some sort of mini trebuchet. Behind him, a full-on snowball war, complete with built-up snow walls for ducking behind, is taking place. Most of the kids from the home are out there, joined by various neighborhood children and adults, too. Lucky, Clint's hapless dog, bounds around trying to snatch snow right out of the air with his mighty jaws. Clint smirks as he packs another snowball into his catapult. Steve's so busy reveling in the joy of the people below that he barely has time to duck to avoid getting a giant snowball to the face. "Break my glass door and I'll break his ugly mug," yells Rachel from inside, when the snow collides with the window, making the whole thing shudder. "Rachel's gonna break your face," Natasha yells down into the street, leaning dangerously far over the railing. "It'd be an honour to have my face broken by such a classy dame," Clint says, holstering his weapon on his back. "Or you could just get down here and join in the fun." Natasha goes right over the rail, working her way down the 5-story building. The war in the street takes a break, so everyone can gape at her, while Clint encourages a couple of kids to start pelting her with snowballs. No one's brave enough to do it, and when Natasha reaches the ground, she launches herself at Clint, cleanly tackling him into a nearby snowbank. Lucky barks his head off and leaps on Natasha's back a second later. "Go join them," Rachel says, as Steve comes back inside when the tips of his fingers start to burn with the cold. "You know what they're doing down there?" Beck snorts. It's the first big snow of the year. It doesn't take a genius to know what they're doing down there. "Don't forget your scarf," Rachel finishes. Steve might never get used to the way they take turns speaking now, like they've got one shared mind, like they are a singular entity speaking with two mouths. Steve wraps a scarf around his neck and grabs his jacket. Steve leads an elite unit of neighborhood kids to surround and attack the snow fort Clint and Natasha ensconce themselves in by the dumpsters in the alley. He puts on an over-exaggerated version of his Captain America voice as he doles out orders, just to make the kids giggle behind their mittens. Tammy, who'd never so much looked at a baseball before Steve taught her to throw one on Thanksgiving, retained her lessons well, and she even manages to peg Natasha in the side of the head when she peeks above the snow wall to yell at Lucky to get back in the safety of their fort. Steve's unit has the numbers and the superior strategy, but they are too easily distracted by stray, slobbering Labradors, so they are ultimately defeated by a sneak attack from Clint and Natasha. Steve's confident in their ability to regroup, but then Eduardo, one of the newer kids to the home, catches a stray snowball from somewhere right in the eye and Steve calls it before anyone gets hurt worse. There's an ice cream shop just down the block, Tammy says, as they all trudge back to the home. Ice cream? Eduardo sounds properly horrified, his teeth chattering as he gapes at Tammy. On days colder than 20 degrees, they sell scoops for a quarter. That's 25 fucking cents. Let's go, let's go. Natasha shrugs. Ice cream is better than pie. Steve treats their whole little group, tipping extravagantly to make up for all the slush they track in with them, and the fact that the shop is scheduled to close in 10 minutes. Those not brave enough to eat ice cream after a snowball fight stick to hot chocolate. The teenager running the place even lets Lucky in, and shyly blushes his way into asking for a selfie with Steve. Everyone pitches in to put up chairs and mop the floor when they're done. They barely make it back to the home for curfew, and Olive greets them at the door, doing her best to look stern and disapproving. Steve's just thankful that Eduardo's eye didn't swell up too bad, or there really would be hell to pay. Instead, she laughs when Steve gives her his most earnest of apologies. Steve lingers at the elevator when all the kids get inside. Through the front windows, he watches Clint and Natasha walk arm in arm in the middle of the street, kicking up snow as they go, laughing and as free as a couple of kids themselves. Lucky runs circles around them. They turn at the end of the street and disappear. Still, the snow falls heavy and thick. Tomorrow, or the next day, when the snow gets hard and black and tread on, such a massive snowball war wouldn't be possible. But this is the fresh stuff, the new stuff. There's enough of it to thoroughly blanket all the concrete of the city. On the elevator, he keeps on grinning, like he's been grinning all day. He startles when he correctly identifies what he's feeling. This is joy. This is happiness. His lungs are tight, but it's from cold air and constant laughter, not asthma or grief. He's tired and content, not exhausted and on the verge of shaking apart. He misses Bucky, who would have had the time of his life with that snowball fight. But it's not such an aching, painful thing. For once, Steve feels alive and part of this 21st century world. When he gets back into the apartment, all the lights are off, and Rachel's crying. He freezes in the hall, because Rachel's crying. Steve remembered what joy feels like tonight, but Rachel's crying, and it ain't right. The girls are in their bedroom, probably even in bed, given the hour, and from down the hallway and around the corner, Steve can hear Rachel crying. "Honey, take a breath," says Beck. He can hear her as clearly as he could if they were standing feet apart, way more clearly than he could hear anything when he was tiny with a terrible ear. Rebecca sounds calm, maybe even a little amused, so there's no reason for Steve to storm through the apartment and slam into their room to do all in his power to make sure Rachel's not sad ever again. This is a private moment, and Steve turns around, determined to hang out in the lobby downstairs or out on the balcony or anywhere, just to keep from eavesdropping. He just smiled so much. Rachel laughs, even as she cries, and Steve pauses with his hand stretched out towards the front door. "I know," says Beck. He can hear the smile in her tone too, wheezy and thin as it is. And laughing. God, I lost count of how many times he laughed tonight. "You count?" "Usually. Not anymore. I stopped at 20. 20! He laughed 20 times. You should bake Natasha something nice." "Bless that girl." Rachel blows her nose. "She's getting pie." "Most of the laughing was a result of something weird she did, you know. I think she's replacing you, Rach." Steve frowns, ready to storm into their bedroom and insist that no one could replace Rachel. Not ever. But Rachel just laughs again. "Good," she says. "I'm far too old to pal around with Steve like it's 1940. He's smiling, Beck. Smiling. We can worry less now, right? For now. I know we were going to talk to him, about getting him set up with a therapist he can actually talk to, about Bucky and everything. But he's got a good balance happening now, right? so maybe we should hold off. Just like Steve did not remember Joy until tonight, he also didn't realize how bad off he's been. He's been quiet and forlorn, up at all hours of the night, only eating enough because Rachel reminds him to. Of course he's been worrying the girls. Yes, let's hold off from that worrying. Beck's voice gets even softer, like she's speaking right into Rachel's hair. For now. I'm just happy. He's smiling, Beck. Real smiles. It might actually be okay, someday, Beck replies. That he's here and he's so young. Even after we're gone, he might have a life. He might be more than the weapon they want him to be. If he keeps it up, just taking a few missions and saving the world only when the unimaginable happens, and he balances that with new friends and hanging out with the kids and charity work, he might have a good life ahead of him when we're gone. Steve's legs suddenly and unfortunately lose the ability to support his weight. He leans back against the wall and sinks down till he's just a pile of two big limbs on the carpet, Beck's words rattling around inside his head. When we're gone. When we're gone. When we're gone. We just gotta get him into art school. You should ease up on that. Beck is still talking, like it's normal to be planning for a day in the not-too-distant future for when they are both gone and Steve's alone. As if it's not unimaginable and completely terrifying. I don't think he's drawn anything since he got back. Really? Oh no. Hush, Rach. Don't fret. He's smiling now, and it's only been 9 months. Give him time. He'll be okay. Only 9 months and he's finding people to love him. He won't be alone. He'll be okay. In the morning, the snow has stopped, and Steve's got a new determination to be okay. Figuring out how to actually live in this century was never a priority when it was just for him, but his stability and contentment is important to the girls. It's easier to get out of bed in the morning when it's for the girls. Without meaning to, Rebecca laid out a plan for his future. His last plan for himself in 1945. Kill, maim, destroy every last piece of Hydra after Bucky fell was rather destructive, and somewhere between coming home for dinner to the apartment in Brooklyn and hanging out with the kids living in the home and goofing around with Natasha, Steve lost that urge to destroy himself along with Hydra. He lost that violent compulsion that had him crashing in the Arctic without coming up with any sort of contingency plans for getting back out again. Somewhere along the way, Steve decided to give living in this bizarre, flashy century a go, and listening in on Beck's private conversation with her wife gave him a how-to guide for actually living. He studiously refuses to acknowledge the rest of what he heard after they were done talking about Steve and his smiles. Beck and her conviction that her days are numbered, saying, "Every day I get weaker, Rach. I can feel myself going." And her desire to finish the book before she's gone. "I'll get that piece of shit written. Then that's it. That's everything I ever wanted to do." So Steve makes a list, around all the moving pieces Beck wants for him, of what's important to him, of how he wants to fill up his life now. He wants to serve. He wants people nearby who love him, who know him. He wants Beck to finish her book. And with his list, he builds a routine. He goes into SHIELD on weekdays like it's your average 9-to-5 job. When he's there, he focuses on giving his super-soldiered body an outlet to let off some energy, or he trains new recruits. He refuses some public appearances because he doesn't like what they're about, and seeks out more on his own, enlisting the help of Pepper for more charities to get involved in. He remains picky about missions, only taking short ones that require a small team, and only agreeing after a thorough briefing from Natasha on why the death they will dole out is necessary. Back in Brooklyn, he spends his time cooking and baking in the kitchen with Rachel, or working on the book with Beck. Despite his refusal to believe that Rachel and Beck will ever die, he's more urgent about getting the book done. Beck's breath comes in so short, and there's a deadline. This is the last thing Beck wants to do with her life, and it's Steve's priority now, too. On weekends, he explores the city, usually on foot. He walks slow, walks alone, tries to take it all in, tries to be a part of it. He comes home and hangs out with the kids. He helps Eduardo with his history homework. He throws around a baseball in the street, weather permitting, with Tammy. He takes them all to the movies or for ice cream or to the park. He doesn't leave the apartment for the whole week the world thinks Tony Stark is dead. He barely sleeps, just watches the footage of Tony's California house getting destroyed, the blurry image of Tony himself falling, falling, falling. When he does close his eyes, he dreams about Bucky falling, too. Natasha calls. She says, I'm 99% sure he's not actually dead. That's a thing that happens these days, you know? People not actually dying when you think they do. Anyway, I'm looking into it. Stay near your shield, all right? I'll call you in if I need to. She doesn't need to. Tony, miraculously not dead, saves the world. He destroys the Mandarin and saves the president, and texts Steve a whole slew of Iron Man emojis, when Steve congratulates him on continuing to be alive and kicking. Steve replies, Let's get Indian next time you're in New York. Tony says, It's a date, Cap. It's easy to step back into his routine after that little scare. He gets up, helps the girls get up, makes breakfast, goes to the city, drinks coffee with Clint, trains until he manages to break a sweat, sits through meetings, jogs home, hangs out with the girls, lather, rinses, repeat. It's a start. We should get married, Rachel says on her 18th birthday. They celebrated with a night out in Harlem at a jazz club to watch Peter play his trombone. Then there was dancing and stumbling back to Sully's for another round. Now they're here, sprawled out on the sofas upstairs in Sully's apartment, listening to Rachel talk nonsense. This time last year, Steve also spent a night drinking at Sully's, but he went home alone to eventually confess to Bucky that he'd been spending all his time in a queer bar. This birthday of Rachel's is better. Rachel, who's got Zelda's head in her lap, would probably agree. Rachel's feet are kicked up on the coffee table, sipping a beer and still looking birthday beautiful, even with her makeup smudged and her dress wrinkling. The dress is really killer, red and fitted, and something Rachel apparently sewed herself, with Frank's help. Zelda's faded since they got back to Sully's. Probably all that dancing she did with Bucky earlier in the night, while Steve and Rachel leaned against the bar, watching and laughing. She's stretched out on the couch now, her eyes half closed. With one hand, Rachel picks bobby pins out of Zelda's hair, flicking them lazily in Bucky's general direction. On the love seat across from them, Steve is equally comfortable and equally drunk. Around him, the room is spinning slightly. It's still pleasant, rather than nauseating, but he dutifully sips on a glass of water instead of joining Rachel in a nightcap to keep things from going downhill quick. He's propped up in the corner of the sofa, between the arm and the back cushions. Bucky's lying against his chest, long legs stretched out and shoes kicked off in the corner. Maybe in a moment, Bucky's weight will get too heavy, but Steve likes it when they sit like this, with Bucky draped over him and his head resting on Steve's chest, close enough so Steve can nose at his hairline. This is the only time he feels big, with Bucky curled up small on top of him. With Bucky's head tucked below his chin, Steve feels like he can actually keep Bucky safe, right here in his arms. Out in the world, Bucky's always pulling him out of fights or working constantly to keep Steve from dying every winter. But with Bucky lying here, it's like Steve can keep Bucky safe, too. He can wrap him up and hide him away and let Bucky feel the good parts of being small. Let Bucky feel surrounded and protected. Because there are good parts to being small, outside the shame and frustration of constantly being undervalued, dismissed, his body too weak to keep up with his iron will. Steve might only remember the good parts of being small when Bucky spoons around his back or when they go to sleep, or when he presses Steve against the bedroom wall, lifting him easily. but there are good parts. Being held, feeling secure and taken care of and loved. That's how Steve feels in Bucky's arms. And he hopes Bucky feels the same when he lies on Steve's chest, face tucked away against Steve's neck. Wow, Steve sure is a sappy drunk tonight. Still, he lets his fingers trace the length of Bucky's spine, and he very much wishes they went home instead of coming up to Rachel's place. I mean it, Rachel says again, when no one offers more than a sleepy chuckle in response to the nonsense she's talking. We should get married. Zelda snickers, turning her head slightly to look up at Rachel. We should get married, for real, Rachel says again. She sits up a little straighter, her voice less drunk and more confident. They know plenty of fellas at the bar who will introduce you to their husbands, but getting married for real, with the church and the paperwork and the whole bit, certainly is not an option. Are you proposing to me, darling? Zelda asks. No. Rachel dislodges another bobby pin. Well, not really. I'm proposing to Steve. Steve, only half paying attention, in favour of pressing his fingers into the bumps of Bucky's spine, jumps a little. What? Says Bucky, lifting his head and glaring. And a moment ago, Steve was sure he was sleeping. What? Says Zelda, pouting. Oh, Rach, says Steve, grinning, laughing like it's a joke. I'm flattered. My fella seems to have objections, though. I'm not joking around here, Rachel insists. And she sounds so serious that Zelda actually sits up and puts some space between them on the couch, crossing her arms over her chest. It's perfect, don't you see? I marry Steve. Zelda, you marry Bucky. Your family already thinks we're all heading in that direction, anyhow. And we live happily ever after in apartments right next door to each other. No one has to know where we really spend our nights. No one has to know who we're really married to. Rachel waggles her eyebrows, and it makes Zelda laugh. And that makes Bucky laugh. But Steve doesn't. He's too busy wanting that. The future Rachel's laying out. Bucky's been silent on the subject of marriage for the last year. But Steve never forgets that this is temporary for Bucky. He said so when they got together. He fully intends for them both to have wives someday. And with all the laughing, Rachel blinks and then looks a little bashful, her cheeks turning red. She giggles too, and the conversation changes like it was all a big joke and not the potential solution to all their problems. The conversation changes, Rachel's proposal seemingly forgotten, but when they say goodbye an hour later, Rachel hugs him a little longer than normal and gives him a significant look as she shuts the door with them in the hall. Rachel's not kidding around here, and neither is Steve. Hey, Buck, Steve murmurs on the walk home. Hmm? Bucky replies, barely paying attention. He's asleep on his feet, hands pressed deep into his pockets as he stumbles forward. If he had his way, they'd be crashing on Sully's love seat for the night, but Steve insisted on going home. He wraps his fingers around Bucky's elbow to keep him on the sidewalk and away from the gutter. It was a good idea, he says. Rachel's little proposition. Bucky snorts and shakes his head. Why not? Steve struggles to keep them walking in a mostly straight line. If Steve were halfway sober, he'd save this conversation for when Bucky's all the way sober. But instead, he just ploughs on. I want you forever, and as far as I can tell, this is the best way to do it. I mean, there's always confirmed bachelorhood, but that ain't gonna work for your family. Plus, Rachel deserves real, legal, on-paper family. This is the safest way for all of us. Bucky's still shaking his head. You like girls, Steve, and one of these days you'll find one that you actually love. So you'll marry her and I'll still be your best friend, but there's no way in hell I'm watching you tie your life to Rachel's when she can't give you a real marriage. How many fucking times do I gotta tell you that it ain't happening, that you're it for me? Bucky shrugs and keeps walking, suddenly able to stay upright on his own by some miracle. "Don't I get a say in what I want at all?" Steve yells at his back. Bucky doesn't even turn around. "You've always been terrible at looking out for yourself, pal. Trust me on this one." Steve's so mad that he tries to sleep on the couch. But the thing is misshapen, and it's so cold out in the living room. He's gotten used to listening to Bucky breathe as he falls asleep, the sound far superior to any lullaby Steve's ever heard, even if Bucky's got an excellent singing voice. He gives up after 30 minutes, and when he pushes open the door, Bucky says, "Oh, thank God," and throws back the covers. It becomes the theme of the summer. Well, along with the ever-escalating war. The Nazis invade France, Belgium, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and Rachel plans a double wedding every time she's had even a sip of alcohol. Paris falls in a matter of days, and Steve says, "I'll marry you in the morning, Rachel Rosenbaum." And Bucky pouts, and Zelda laughs, like the whole thing is still a big joke, instead of everything Steve's always wanted. The Soviets take Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, the Nazis bomb Britain, and Rachel sketches out wedding dresses in Steve's notebook. Europe is on fire, and Bucky's being so stubborn about this marriage scheme, but it's still the best summer of Steve's life. He's coming off a winter season where he wasn't sick at all, just a minor cold between Christmas and Thanksgiving that cleared up by New Year's. Which means all that money they put aside every paycheck for medical emergencies grows so large that Bucky agrees they can stop adding so much to it. All of a sudden, they have spending money. All of a sudden, they're almost comfortable. So their summer fills up with drinking their way through the queer bars of the village and attending jazz shows in Harlem at clubs with actual covers. Bucky gets a new suit. Steve gets a new easel. They take the girls out to fancy dinners in the city, to restaurants that cater to queer clientele, and they dress like swells and all do their best to talk in overly posh accents. They see Bucky's family, George included, at least once a week, and each dinner is a little less strained, a little more comfortable, until family time becomes something to look forward to instead of something to dread. Along with church and family dinner once a week, they go to all sorts of ball games, a whole big group of them. George and Uncle Tommy, Beck and Hank, Steve and Bucky. Rachel even tags along on occasion, although her knowledge of the sport is embarrassingly lacking. It gives Hank a chance to blather on in great detail about Hugh Casey's stats for the last couple seasons, and the strategy of batting orders. Beck brings a book to read, but she always manages to be looking when the Dodgers score a run. It's a winning season so far, a cherry on top of Steve's already perfect summer. The radio drones on about war in Europe, but Steve's never been happier. On weekends, they join the crowds at the beach. Zelda schedules her shifts around free days at art museums across the city, and Steve goes with her to the Brooklyn Museum 4 times in 3 months. His art benefits from the best summer of Steve's life, too. He gets bolder, painting scenes from Sully's for his WPA works. His crowded, gritty scenes could rival Reggie Marsh, and suddenly, his art looks like he spends more time with queers than normals, a reflection of their neighborhood and Steve's life. Bucky's right there with him, through all of it, and he might be against Steve and Rachel's grand marriage plan, but he certainly acts like he's married to Steve already. He kisses Steve goodbye in the mornings when he leaves for the refinery, and he wraps his arms around Steve's waist the moment he gets home in the afternoon. They make their plans together, sorting through life's little trivialities, same as he's heard Winnie and George do countless times. Their money merges, until Steve genuinely loses track of who's making what. He just hands over his paychecks to Bucky and watches him count out their budget, making piles on the table for bills, rent, food, Steve's medicine, Bucky's grooming products, and spending money. When they go out, Steve offers no complaint when Bucky carries the money and buys their drinks. He's always had a head for numbers anyhow. When the nights get a chill in the air around Bucky's birthday in September, Steve mourns the end of summer. These have been the most perfect months of his life, and if he had his way, he'd just continue living them over and over again, indefinitely. Like his mama before him, Steve paints the windows of the Boyd's butcher shop every 3 weeks. When it's just Mr. Boyd in the shop, Steve can get done painting and get paid and on his way in just under 2 hours. When it's Mrs. Boyd hanging around, there is small talk involved, and Steve ends up staying in the shop for an extra 15 minutes, minimum. When Rachel dines to show up on days when Mrs. Boyd is around, well, Steve might as well just put a cot in the corner and take a nap, because he won't be leaving the butcher's for the rest of his natural-born life. This morning, Steve got up before the sun, leaving a very naked and very warm Bucky in their bed, and arrived a couple hours before opening. It's officially fall now, and Steve grumbled about the need to pull on a coat on his way out the front door. The whole point was to get this done early, and still have a whole Saturday to enjoy with Bucky afterwards. Rachel, probably walking home from spending the night at Zelda's, decided to pop in just as Steve was cleaning his brushes, and she's been engaged in small talk with Mrs. Boyd for going on 45 years. Steve seriously considers just leaving her here, but Mrs. Boyd's fairly well convinced that Steve and Rachel are going to tie the knot at any moment now, and what kind of fella would just ditch his sweetheart at the butcher's anyhow? And maybe Mrs. Boyd is right about that. Bucky seems to be crumbling a little on the marriage front. Maybe next summer, if all stays the same, he'll finally agree. Steve stretches his back, shifting his weight from foot to foot as he stands dutifully at Rachel's side, as she discusses the weather, the newest neighbourhood gossip, and the best way to cook down beef stock with Mrs. Boyd. His attention drifts, and he gazes out the window, looking around his freshly painted cartoon pigs and cows, at all the people going about their business on the sidewalk. The weather is still nice enough during the day. There's a decent amount of foot traffic, people trying to soak up as much sun as possible before the coming winter. A trio of youngsters pass. They look an awful lot like Bucky's siblings. When they push through the door and into the butcher's shop a second later, Steve realizes they are, in fact, Bucky's siblings. "Rebecca Barnes," says Mrs. Boyd, stopping in the middle of a sentence to gush at Bucky's little sister. "I haven't seen you around this neighborhood in ages, not since that father of yours packed you off to Park Slope. It's nice to see you outside church." "Hi, Mrs. Boyd," Beck says, only grimacing a bit. She's even less disposed for small talk than Steve is. "You mind if I steal Steve here? He and my brother are supposed to take us all to Coney Island today." Steve could kiss Rebecca Barnes. He really could. "Of course. You just have a grand old time. And tell your mama I'll see her on Sunday." They make their escape, Rachel appearing less than thrilled by the sudden change of events. Steve waits a whole block, until they are out of sight of the butcher shop, to pull back into a hug. "You saved my life, Rebecca," he says, kissing her cheek. "I swear I was going to die in that shop. She was going to talk me to death." "What a way to go," Beck says, shaking her head. Rachel mutters something under her breath that Steve doesn't catch. "What are you three doing around here anyhow?" Steve asks. Despite weekly gatherings with the Barnes family, Zelda comes with them to church most Sundays, while Rachel comes to family dinners. The three kids have never just stopped by like this before. This summer they've struck a balance that seems to work for everyone, even if the whole thing is just a fragile house of cards built on a foundation of lies. But that balance still hasn't included Beck showing up with the twins. "I told you," says Beck. She sets off in the direction of Steve and Buck's place, the twins trailing along behind her, whispering and laughing in each other's ears. "Coney Island." "I think I would have remembered plans to go to Coney Island." "We definitely don't have plans for Coney Island." Rachel says Coney Island like it's the most vile place imaginable, conveniently forgetting that she's been talking about going at least once more, while it's still warm enough to stick their toes in the surf without losing a foot to frostbite. Anything to be snippy with Beck. Beck scowls. "Well, now you do. Come on, Tate even gave me money, but he says I'm not responsible enough to take the twins on my own. He said you have to come." Steve's footsteps falter. "Really? Your pop wants Buck and me to supervise?" "Yes." "Well, You did lose Hannah and Gimbals for 6 hours that one time. It was 2 hours, and that was ages ago. When Steve laughs at her, Beck takes a big breath and unclenches her hands at her sides. Tati might have actually mentioned that incident this morning when he sent me off to ask you and Buck to take us. When they get back to their building, Beck insists on waiting out front with the twins instead of coming up to get Bucky. Steve's grateful, as it would be a bit of a trick to keep the kids from seeing their beds pushed together. He wonders if Beck has some inkling of this, if that's why she chose to find him at the shop instead of coming to the apartment. Upstairs, Bucky's still in bed, face down and snoring into the pillows. It's the same position he rolled into after he failed to convince Steve to stay in bed for another 5 minutes, and promptly fell back asleep. Now he crawls back into bed. He settles on top of Bucky, stretching out and nuzzling into the side of his head. Underneath him, Bucky shifts around and hums into the pillows. "Rise and shine, Bucko." Steve nibbles on his earlobe, making him groan. "Time to get up."
"No."
Steve presses his laugh into Bucky's neck. He kisses the sensitive skin behind his ear, and Bucky squirms.
"I already got paid today."
Steve sits up. He rests on Bucky's lower back, his legs on either side of his ribs.
"And you haven't even got out of bed."
"It's Saturday." Bucky shuffles around, half-heartedly trying to dislodge Steve.
"Are you wearing shoes? In our bed? What's wrong with you?"
"Come on, you lazy bum," Steve says with a laugh. He tugs a little on Bucky's hair and lets out a rather embarrassing squeak when Bucky abruptly flips around under him, suddenly laid out on his back, Steve now straddling his chest. He's as naked as warm as he was when Steve left him this morning, and even more appealing, as he's awake and staring at Steve's lips like he could eat them for breakfast, his hands on Steve's hips.
"You calling me lazy, huh?"
Bucky whispers, hands finding their way to Steve's belt buckle.
"Let's get these goddamn shoes out of bed, and I'll prove to you just how lazy I am."
Steve's got to close his eyes and concentrate real hard on the fact that Bucky's kid siblings and Rachel are all waiting out front on the sidewalk for them, just to summon the strength to bat Bucky's hands away.
"Don't you talk to me like that when your siblings are waiting on us to take them to Coney Island."
Bucky sits up so fast, Steve nearly tumbles right out of his lap. "They're here." Bucky gets all pale as he stares at the open bedroom door. "Outside," Steve corrects, running his hands up and down Bucky's chest to calm him down. "They're out on the sidewalk with Rachel. Apparently, your pop gave them money, but does not trust Rebecca to return at the end of the day with both twins in tow." Bucky, somehow, manages to look even more shocked than he did a minute ago, when he thought that Steve had half his family in their apartment and was still crawling all over him with the door open.
"Tate wants us to take the kids," Bucky asks.
"Tate, my father, that's the fella that is specifically asking us, me and you, to take his children out for the day? He's trusting us, you and me, over Rebecca?"
Yeah, according to Beck anyhow. She did lose Hannah and Gimbals that one time.
"Oh," Bucky says, and then he falls flat on his back and covers his face with his hands.
"Buck?"
Steve tugs on his wrist, but Bucky's hands won't budge.
"What, do you not want to go?"
"I want to go."
Bucky's voice hitches.
"Are you crying?"
"No."
"Bucky?"
"I'm not."
He drops his hands to prove that he is, in fact, not actually crying, but he still looks close.
"I'm okay. I just..."
"What, honey?" Steve murmurs, rubbing circles over Bucky's heart.
"What's wrong?"
"Just didn't think Tata would let us anywhere near the twins without parental supervision, is all." Cocking his head to the side, Steve leans back and blinks down at Bucky. Taking the kids out on their own seems like the natural next step, given that they've steadily been seeing more of the Barneses for months. After Mass, they're invited back home for lunch. Beck shows up on their doorsteps all the time. Winnie actually smiles for real when she sees them. Every Tuesday, Bucky goes to the gym to box with his father and his uncles. A day at Coney Island with the kids shouldn't be such a shock. Wait, Steve murmurs as he thinks it through. Is this... When you left home, was it because George didn't want you around the twins? Didn't trust you around Hank? Bucky doesn't say anything, but he closes his eyes, and that's as good as screaming out the affirmative in Bucky speak. Your father, Steve repeats, because he doesn't quite believe it. Thought you'd hurt Hank after he found out about us, because we're queer. Steve, it's fine. We're going to Coney Island. Get your sweet patootie off me so I can get dressed. Your father, George Elijah Barnes, thinks... Bucky sighs and dumps Steve off his lap, hopping out of bed and digging through the dresser. I just can't believe it, Buck, Steve whispers, curling up on his side and hugging a spare pillow to his chest. Why not? You know what all those moralists say about us perverts, Steve. Can't let us anywhere near your kids, especially the little boys. Bucky pulls on some trousers over his underwear, casual as anything, and Steve winces. George knows Bucky. How could he ever, even for one little minute, think something so vile of his own son? I just can't believe it, Steve says again. How could he think that about you? Wasn't just me he was thinking that about, pal. Oh, says Steve. He presses his face to Bucky's pillow and breathes deep. Maybe it was a good thing that Bucky's never told him the full story of what happened with his parents in 36. If it gets any worse than this, Steve's better off not knowing. Hey. Bucky runs his fingers through Steve's hair, encouraging him to get his head out of the pillows. When Steve looks up, he's surprised to see Bucky fully dressed and looking at him so softly. There's no use fretting over it now. It's done. In the past. Things are better. I guess. Bucky smiles and swats at Steve's ass. Come on, you lazy bum. If you take Hannah and I take Hank, I think we've got a decent chance of not losing at least one of them. So Steve gets out of bed and follows Bucky out of the bedroom. He breathes deep, pushing down, down, down everything bad. He's determined not to feel any of this any longer, determined to just enjoy the day. Bucky? Steve tugs on Bucky's elbow to keep him from unlocking the front door and walking out into the hall. He wraps his arms around Bucky's neck, tugs him close to whisper in his ear. You're the most trustworthy man I know, and I love you a lot. Kiss me, okay? Bucky kisses him, and then kisses him a little more, before they finally get out of the apartment and meet up with everyone out on the street. Steve manages to fake a grin and deliver some quip about how it's impossible to get Bucky out of bed in the morning that has Rachel smirking, but he's quiet on the train. He doesn't manage a smile until Bucky cajoles him onto the Wonder Wheel. It gets dark, they get back to the neighbourhood, and Steve absolutely does not want to go back to the Barnes for dinner. But Rebecca insists. You're invited, she says. Did I not mention that this morning? That was the plan for the day. Rope you two into taking us to Coney Island and reward you with dinner. Rachel begs off to work a shift behind the bar. She kisses Steve's cheek and whispers in his ear. I know something's wrong. Tell me later. He nods and she leaves, and Steve can't figure out a way to get out of dinner, not when Bucky's agreeing to go. Steve would rather not see George ever again, but he's equally unwilling to leave Bucky alone. When they get to the house, Bucky smiles at his father, and Steve relaxes slightly, only because it's damn near impossible to be so mad when Bucky is smiling. Tate, Bucky says in greeting, reaching out to shake his father's hand. It used to be hugs instead of handshakes. Didn't think I'd be seeing you till Tuesday. What, you think this is the week you finally beat your old man? George lifts his fists, throwing a couple of gentle punches into Bucky's arm. With a twin hanging off each leg, his footwork is a mess. You know I let you win out of the kindness of my heart. Bucky crosses his arms over his chest and grins. Gotta look out for your fragile old man ego. Enough, enough, says Winnie, when George tries to give Bucky a noggy and Bucky spins away. Come eat, you're late. Bucky rolls his eyes and squares up his stance, gently punching Steve's forearms until Steve laughs and starts boxing back. Winnie sighs a lot, but she smiles when George kisses her cheek. She says, go wash up, and all the Barnes kids shuffle out of the foyer to follow her instructions. Hello, Steve, says George with a warm smile, as Steve follows Bucky and his siblings. George. The name leaves a bad taste in his mouth, but if Bucky's forgiven his father, then Steve has to, too. Eventually. Someday. Certainly not tonight. After dinner, everyone lingers. It's nice, so long as he doesn't look in George's direction. And as much as he appreciates and adores both Rachel and Zelda, enjoying the company of the Barnes is easier without the girls with them. It's like being a kid again, so in awe that this tight-knit group would welcome a sickly little scrapper with a big mouth and holes in the knees of his pants. And then so relieved to still have people who loved him after his mother died. Without Rachel and Zelda, it's easy to ignore that the only reason they're back in the family fold is that they've managed to prove they're normal enough to be around the kids, that they're not so queer that they'll end up confirmed bachelors for the rest of their days. Without the girls here, Steve gets to sit next to Bucky. There's one little moment, one little slip-up, when they get too comfortable and too relaxed over Irish coffee and chocolate babka. Bucky leans back in his chair, throwing his arm over the back of Steve's. Steve's too busy laughing at Beck. Some boy from her class had the audacity to offer to take her out for egg creams, apparently. To be as careful as he usually is about touching Bucky outside their apartment or Sully's. He leans into Bucky's hand, because it's habit, smiling as Bucky messes with the hair at the back of his neck, even as he keeps listening to Beck complain. It takes him a solid 10 seconds to notice Winnie across the table, noticing Bucky's hand. Her eyes are wide, nostrils flared. She looks more scared than angry, more panicked than on the verge of kicking them out all over again. Steve ducks his head and smacks away Bucky's hand. He says, quit messing with my hair, you jerk. Bucky freezes for a second, but he understands quickly, pulling Steve into a headlock and ruffling his hair. They shove each other. Just a couple of normal guys roughhousing. Nothing to see here, honest. They've got sweethearts waiting for them back home. They stay for another cup of spiked coffee, and then Bucky makes a big show of looking at his watch, exclaiming about how he's going to be late to meet Zelda. He's apparently promised to walk her home from the hospital. We're so bad at this, Bucky mutters when they're out on the sidewalk. I don't know, Buck. Steve links his arm with Bucky's as they set off in the direction of home. I think we're doing great. This is all going to work out fine after you agree to marry me. Bucky just sighs for about 3 blocks straight, but he's smiling just a little. Two days later, the Selective Service Act passes, and Steve is abruptly reminded that his plans don't matter. Wearing Bucky down into marriage ain't going to guarantee them a future. Not with Paris lost and the US government beefing up its armed services, and the possibility that the pair of them will be drafted at any moment. Like all the men in their neighborhood between the ages of 21 and 35, Steve and Bucky go stand in line to register with the nearest draft board. Steve watches as Bucky stands there, face blank and stoic, leg jiggling. He's so strapping and brave, but nervous, too. It'll be boys just like Bucky, George told him a year ago. They'll destroy boys just like Bucky, but not you. Steve stands there, shivering and back aching, waiting to sign up for the draft. He watches Bucky, beautiful, capable, perfect Bucky, and he knows that George was right. When the war finally comes to America, it'll take Bucky, and Steve will be left behind.